According to a study by the Pew Research Center, LGBTQ people are the most likely minority group to be targeted by hate crimes, about twice as likely as Black people.
The Jazz Age Harlem offered an openness and freedom for those in the life.
A historical novel set in the 1920s, the protagonist is a doctor who happens to be gay.
This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Bermuda separates equality from marriage, hate on the rise horrifies queer youth, and culture heroes expand boundaries into rainbow minutes. All that and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 10th, 2018. Bermuda had the dubious distinction this week of becoming the first country on Earth to repeal marriage equality. After weeks of deliberation, Governor John Rankin gave royal assent on February 7th to Bermuda's Domestic Partnership Act 2017. The Queen's official approval, through the governor of the British Overseas Territory, was required before the bill could become law. Royal assent is almost always a simple formality. The measure overturned a May 2017 marriage equality ruling by the island nation's Supreme Court and replaced it with a separate domestic partnership option for same-gender couples. The current government, bolstered by loud and vocal evangelical Christian leaders, made overturning the court's equality ruling an issue during the subsequent campaign last year. Minister of Home Affairs Walton Brown claims that domestic partners will have all the rights of heterosexual married couples. Equality proponents disagree. Bermuda is, of course, highly dependent on tourism. For better or worse, calls for boycotts, which would impact LGBT Bermudans who work in those businesses, too, have already begun.
It's of little solace to Winston Godwin and Greg DeRoche, whose lawsuit led to the Bermuda High Court ruling, that the bill allowed them and about a half dozen other queer couples who wed after the ruling to stay legally married. Mark Pettengill, the country's former attorney general, successfully argued the Godwin-DeRoche case before the Supreme Court. He said he hoped that other litigants would step forward to launch a legal challenge to the new law. He told the Royal Gazette that, "We are dealing with something that became legal on the basis of human rights issues and is now being effectively taken away by an act of Parliament. It presents a far tougher case and a far longer and potentially more drawn-out battle." Opposition parties in Britain and politicians in groups from inside and outside the UK have condemned the government's royal assent. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, with whom Governor Rankin is said to have consulted, said that he decided that it was not appropriate for the government to veto a decision by the island's lawmakers.
The Reuters news agency reported this week that some 200 unlicensed clinics to cure same-gender sexual attraction are doing big business in Ecuador. Despite gay sex being decriminalized there in 1997, clinic operators claim that homosexuality is a mental illness that needs corrective therapy. Caetano Salal, a spokesperson for one of the country's leading LGBT advocacy groups, said that the clinics operate clandestinely in private alcohol and drug rehabilitation facilities. Queer or questioning victims are usually forced into the clinic by family members and held against their will. Activists charged that they are routinely raped and beaten as part of the therapy. A spokeswoman for Ecuador's health ministry told Reuters that, "We frequently verify with our teams that these types of establishments do not exist where human rights violations can take place." But Salao called the existence of the clinics a reality that the government seemingly doesn't want to face. Activists are calling on the nation's courts to intervene and fully eradicate the medically debunked practice. Although Ecuador passed a law in 2016 allowing people to choose their preferred gender on identity cards, and its first transgender lawmaker took office last year, socially conservative attitudes are entrenched in the South American nation, bolstered by the increasingly powerful evangelical wing of the Roman Catholic Church.
A former television journalist and evangelical Christian singer and lawmaker bolted to the top of the first round of presidential elections in Costa Rica on February 4th. Political observers credit the meteoric rise of Fabricio Alvarado in a crowded field of 13 candidates to his outspoken condemnation of the January Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruling that said civil marriage should be opened to same-gender couples throughout the region. With about 90% of the precincts reporting, the nation's electoral board said that the 43-year-old Alvarado had won 25% of the vote. He'll face marriage equality supporter and former labor minister Carlos Quesada in a runoff election. At the age of 38, the youngest in the race, Quesada came in second with 22%. Alvarado managed to upend the usual political debates about corruption, crime, and the economy to make opposition to marriage equality in the heavily Roman Catholic Central American country his campaign centerpiece. He called the Inter-American Court ruling, which had actually been requested by the current government, a violation of Costa Rica's sovereignty and an affront to traditional family values. Public opinion polls suggest that a majority of respondents in Costa Rica who had heard about the ruling agree with him. The runoff election will be held on April 1st.
The Trump administration announced this week that the president's new policy on military service by transgender Americans would be introduced on February 21st. That's the deadline Trump gave Defense Secretary James Mattis to submit an implementation plan to ban future enlistment by transgender people and perhaps even discharge currently serving transgender enlistees. The Obama administration opened service to qualified transgender personnel after a comprehensive study of the issue by the Pentagon that determined that their integration into the armed forces would not pose a challenge to morale or good order. A separate study by the RAND Corporation also disputed one of Trump's rationales for the ban by concluding that associated health care costs would also be minimal. Human Rights Campaign National Press Secretary Sarah McBride pointed out in a media statement that there has already been an extensive and thorough study of allowing transgender people to serve openly, a process which led the Pentagon 2 years ago to announce that the United States would join 18 other nations that allow open trans service. In their repeated attempts to implement and justify this cruel and unconstitutional policy, the statement charges, the Trump-Pence administration has been the only source of disruption on this issue. Activists look to the federal courts to block any attempted ban. A number of judges have already issued temporary injunctions to prevent Trump's proposal from going forward.
More out-and-proud athletes from around the world are competing in the Winter Olympic Games than ever before. The 2018 edition in Pyeongchang, South Korea, kicked off this week with at least 14 openly LGBT competitors. Perhaps two of the more high-profile queer Olympians are U.S. freestyle skier Gus Kenworthy and figure skater Adam Rippon. Rippon made headlines by rejecting an offer from Vice President Mike Pence's office for a face-to-face meeting during the Games. He had criticized the fact that Pence was to lead the U.S. delegation, pointing to the former Indiana governor's support for so-called cure therapy and his several other anti-LGBT actions. Kenworthy agreed with Rippon during an appearance on Ellen DeGeneres' daytime talk show this week.
We're going into the Olympics, and myself and Adam Rippon are the two first openly gay males competing in the Olympics, and it's just incredible to see how times have changed because of people like you and athletes in the past and so many people that have paved the way. But then to have someone leading the delegation that's like directly attacked the LGBT community and just a cabinet in general that just sort of stands against us and has tried to do things to set us back, it just seems like a bad fit. And I feel like the Olympics is all about inclusion and people coming together, and it seems like it's not really doing that.
Friends Kenworthy and Rippon posted photos on Instagram this week from South Korea, one showing Kenworthy giving Rippon a peck on the cheek with the caption, "Eat your heart out, Pence." There were reports that the vice president continues to pursue a face-to-face meeting with Rippon. The gay figure skater said he was open to that, but only after the Olympics. "I've been waiting 28 years to be here," he said, "and I want to do everything I can to stay focused and ready for this opportunity." You can follow all the queer action at the Winter Olympics on many of your favorite LGBT news outlets, including Outsports.com.
And finally, fans of America's National Football League, Philadelphia Eagles, flocked to Minneapolis on February 4th for the Super Bowl, where their team upset the defending champion New England Patriots. Because it's named the Eagle Bolt, several Philadelphia fans who couldn't get tickets to the game mistakenly mistook it for a fan watering hole. One told the Minneapolis Star Tribune that, "We were just walking around as we were looking for a bar. I said, 'We're stopping there. It says Eagle.'" The Eagle Bolt is a gay leather bar. Owner Ed Hopkins said that the Eagles fans who stumbled into it enjoyed being in our place. "They were very rowdy and fun. We enjoyed having them in our establishment." Sid Ziegler wrote on Outsports.com that, "You don't have to be gay to watch the Super Bowl in a gay bar. You just have to be cool. And it sounds like a bunch of cool Eagles fans had the night of their lives in a gay bar called Eagle."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 10th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap, from This Way Out, is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Young love, our love, we share with deep emotion.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all of our sexually diverse communities.
Black entertainers rubbed elbows with homosexuals and transvestites, which was considered quite chic.
"I am the first to admit that I like to see myself reflected on the page, but I am also captivated by the lives of characters who are different than me."
You don't own me.
You too will be rubbing elbows with homosexuals in Harlem, and even an author and an iconic entertainer. But first, some queer young people who should be thinking about life and love have hate on their minds.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Nico, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Andrea talks about Matthew Shepard, who became a victim of a deadly assault because he was gay. His murder highlights a historic lack of legal protections for LGBTQ people. Andrea talks about how this injustice has partially been lessened by new laws and awareness, yet has also continued in many ways.
In 1998, a 21-year-old openly gay college student named Matthew Shepard was kidnapped by two men his age. They drove him to an out-of-the-way part of town, punched him repeatedly, and hit him about 20 times with the butt of a pistol. They left him tied to a fence, unconscious and mangled, until he was found 18 hours later. He was brought to the hospital, and he died 6 days after the attack. Matthew Shepard's murder attracted enormous media attention because of suspicions that his sexuality was the motivation for the crime, particularly because his attackers repeatedly used anti-gay slurs throughout their confessions and testimony. The murder of Matthew Shepard is an example of a hate crime. The FBI defines a hate crime as a criminal offense against a person or property motivated in whole or in part by an offender's bias against race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, or gender identity. It's important to note that simply hating someone is not illegal, as it falls within one's right to freedom of expression. But committing a crime based on hatred of a minority group is an act often meant to terrorize an entire community, and it's not protected free expression. It's a criminal action against a member of a group that's motivated by hate of that group. That makes it a hate crime, and the designation of a crime as a hate crime can increase the punishment or allow more resources to be provided for prosecution. At the time of Matthew Shepard's murder in 1998, There was no hate crime law in Wyoming, the state in which the crime occurred, so his attackers were not convicted of a hate crime. Additionally, federal hate crime law did not cover crimes motivated by sexual orientation. As a result, when the local police department asked for resources from the federal government, the U.S. Department of Justice couldn't help. In 2009, President Obama signed the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. It expanded federal hate crime law to include crimes motivated by sexual orientation or gender identity, and it altered the existing law to help the federal government better provide resources to address all hate crimes. If the law had been in place in 1998, the federal government would have been able to allocate resources to the prosecution of Matthew Shepard's murderers. Part of the rationale behind hate crime laws protecting LGBTQ people is that we are statistically much more likely to become victims. Perhaps one of the most disturbing statistics is that about half of all transgender people and bisexual women experience sexual assault at some point in their lifetimes. People who are members of multiple minority groups are at the highest risk. According to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, about 62% of all LGBTQ homicide victims are people of color. Many minority groupings come with an increased risk of being a crime victim, and hate crime laws can increase punishment for crimes motivated by prejudice against these minorities, hopefully as a deterrent. Unfortunately, hate crimes in America are not uncommon, especially against LGBTQ people. According to a study by the Pew Research Center, LGBTQ people are the most likely minority group to be targeted by hate crimes, about twice as likely as Black people. It gets worse. According to the National Coalition on Anti-Violence report, there was a record number of anti-LGBTQ homicides in 2017. Experts believe that a major cause of this increase is that society is becoming more accepting of people's differences. Because of this, those who are against LGBTQ people might feel marginalized and are therefore more likely to commit violent crimes against them. While these statistics provide some perspective on the occurrence of hate crimes in the United States, they do not paint the complete picture. It is likely that hundreds, if not thousands, of hate crimes go unreported each year. People may be afraid of outing themselves by reporting these crimes, and even when they are reported, many local jurisdictions may not consider them hate crimes, so they pass unnoticed. The crime and discrimination LGBTQ people face is serious. Homophobic and transphobic crime increases the marginalization and fear that LGBTQ people may feel about being open about themselves, not to mention the lives it takes and the harm that it does to the well-being of the LGBTQ community and the people in it. As of January 2018, all but four of the U.S. states have hate crime laws. Of those, only 30 states cover crimes motivated by sexual orientation, and only 17 states cover crimes motivated by gender identity. Increased hate crime protections would help bring justice against discriminatory crime, help prevent it from occurring, and help make all LGBTQ people safer. The Matthew Shepard murder happened before I was born, but it's disheartening that violent crimes against LGBTQ people are as much of an issue today as they were then, despite the incredible progress that we've made in many other areas. Despite all of the ways in which we are safer now than we were years ago, acts of terror against our community make every one of us think, "That could be me." It raises questions about the safety of coming out, of being open about who we are, of simply walking down the street or going to a gay bar or coffee house or bookstore. For many LGBTQ people, the balance of how open to be is a difficult one. Fear of facing violence pushes that balance more towards the side of being afraid to say certain things, wear certain things, or go certain places that could let people know that we're LGBTQ. For a community that has fought so hard for the right to be open about who we are, more stress and fear about whether it's safe is the last thing we need.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producers are Alex Mintz and Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofos. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Like a shooting star, flying across the room, so fast, so far, we're gone too soon.
Hello, I'm Dennis Shepherd, Matthew Shepherd's father, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Make a new acquaintance and remember some golden oldies later in the program. What was it like to be in the life during the Harlem Renaissance? Let's ask the Rainbow Minute crew.
The Harlem Renaissance, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Known as one of the most culturally romantic periods in American history, the Harlem Renaissance would leave a lasting impression. It all began in the very early 1900s when a large migration of Southern blacks transformed the neighborhood just north of New York City's Central Park into the most populous African-American community in the country. By the 1920s, Harlem had become the epicenter of black American art, music, and literature, and soon was exploding with nightlife. The Jazz Age Harlem offered an openness and freedom for those in the life, the term often used for those attracted to their own sex. While the word homosexual was never mentioned, gays and lesbians found a place to flourish. It became fashionable for white partygoers from Manhattan to seek the exotic, unrestrained nightlife of Harlem, where social restrictions were often left at the door. They went to basement speakeasies or to cabarets like the Cotton Club. There, black entertainers rubbed elbows with homosexuals and transvestites, which was considered quite chic. Many partygoers were gay themselves, meeting in Harlem bars that catered to the black and white, the heterosexual and homosexual. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Anna Edwards.
We got silly books!
Sad books!
Good books!
Bad books!
They're all great in their way, but whichever one you choose, hey, you just can't lose. Come on and read a book today!
LGBT books are more than just an obsession for This Way Out's Queer Life and Literature commentator Janet Mason, and Jeff Stuckey's novel Acquaintance reveals why.
One evening before a class I teach, I was telling an adult student that I review LGBT books. I live in a very diverse area where it doesn't seem to matter if you're gay, and I've been coming out to my students for so long that it feels like breathing. This particular student was a little different than the others. She was around my age, so if she had done her homework or at least paid attention over the years, she would have known that there was a time not so long ago when coming out was not so easy. She sniffed in a way that let me know that she didn't have a cold and responded, "Really? Only LGBT books?" Then without pausing, she added rather disdainfully, I thought, "I guess that's your thing." I find LGBT books to be more interesting. I want to know how people survive and often thrive outside the box in a culture that is based on conformity. I didn't say this because my student may have found it to be a defensive statement. Maybe it is. Perhaps it is because I am a lesbian that I find diversity to be more interesting. I am the first to admit that I like to see myself reflected on the page. But I am also captivated by the lives of characters who are different than me. Recently, I opened the pages of a book that had come across my desk and was reminded of this. The book is titled Acquaintance, a novel, part of Medicine for the Blues trilogy, and is by Jeff Stuckey, Pictograph Publishing, Portland, Oregon, 2017. A historical novel set in the 1920s, the protagonist is a doctor who happens to be gay. It is a love story written in a time when gay love was clandestine. As the author writes, love stories get especially messy when the love is forbidden. The story of Romeo and Juliet would have been a simple one if their families had not made their love dangerous. But love will flourish even when it is forbidden. In the novel, I learned about gay life way before the liberation unleashed by the Stonewall Riots in New York City in 1969. I also learned about the medical profession, fishing, Portland, Oregon, music, especially jazz, and the origins of the Ku Klux Klan. There is an interesting subplot regarding the connection between racism and homophobia, and another subplot addresses the realistically drawn lesbian couple in the narrator's life, of whom he is jealous of before he settles down with his male partner. Acquaintance is a well-developed and interesting page-turner, and I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the trilogy. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
And finally this week...
It's still Leslie Gore's party, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Leslie Gore was discovered at age 16 by producer Quincy Jones during a gig at a Manhattan hotel. He signed her to Mercury Records and in 1963 released the number one hit, It's My Party. Gore's remarkable run of hits like Judy's Turn to Cry spoke of teenage crushes and betrayals, securing her place as a teen pop icon. Her second biggest hit was You Don't Own Me. Some considered it a feminist anthem since she crooned, "To live my life the way I want, to say and do whatever I please." Gore later hosted a couple of episodes of In the Life, a gay and lesbian news series on PBS, and started talking publicly about her life as a lesbian. It was her way of offering solace to gays and lesbians in the Midwest who had no one to talk to. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Gene Pembleton.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Monique Lukens and Christopher Gall, produced by Steve Fried, Outcasters Nico and Andrea, produced by Mark Sofos, Anna Edwards and Gene Pembleton, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Janet Mason. Between the Lions and Leslie Gore performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This layout thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org. And on CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, Dade City Community Radio, Dade City, Florida, WRFN Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned!